Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Welcome aboard the choo-choo train called the Carolina Outdoors.
Choo-choo!
Early risers, late comers, all welcome. Whether you're listening to us via the airwaves of WBT Radio as we blast up and down the Eastern Seaboard, or maybe you're subscribing and joining us via the podcast. Highlights of the Carolina Outdoors, wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as at the website, ever popular, jessebrowns.com. Your host on a Saturday morning or any time during the week on the afternoon or evenings that you're listening are right here. Bill Barty on this side of your radio dial or computer and
Christopher Lawing on the other side
of your mobile tablet or device.
Bum, 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 bum.
We're here to talk a lot about the events that are going on this spring in the Carolina outdoors. We hope that you enjoy what you hear. Some of what we're going to be talking about are the seasons that are happening, and we've already covered many of the travels and vacations of spring break. We've encouraged people to get out there for hikes. In fact, we do have a free hike in the city of Charlotte that you're invited to. It's Sunday, April 23rd at 1 p.m. This is a previously planned hike that occurred on a day that rained like the Dickens. So therefore, we picked April 23rd, 1 o'clock. We're going to meet at the Fair Meadows Swim and Racquet Club in the South Park area and do 7.7 miles. Bring comfortable shoes and a water bottle and maybe a few snacks. We're going to finish up at Legion Brewing there in the South Park area. If you don't have any of those things, stop by Jesse Brown's Outdoors or jessebrowns.com. Use code HIKE25, HIKE25. You can get a brand new pair of shoes, $25 off with a $100 purchase. On all products like that, excludes trips and services. And Christopher, with that being said, the other part of the season that is going on right now is it's opening day of turkey season.
Sure is. There's been some good videos going around that I've seen in anticipation of the day, and it's gobble time.
Let me break it down for you, too, because we're going to start in South Carolina. It's got the longer season. In fact, zones 3 and 4, which are kind of Columbia South, the low country of South Carolina. And if you think of South Carolina with that diagonal line that runs from the northeast down to the southwest, that is where those zones are 3 and 4. The opening day is already open March 22nd, and it's going to go through April 30th. The rest of the state, zones 1 and 2, start April 1st and go through May the 10th. And we do have a youth season, a couple of days. The 18th and 19th are going to be in the low country of South Carolina, and zones 1 and 2, which is the northwest corner of South Carolina and the area that we're in here in the Charlotte metro region of South Carolina down to Georgia, the youth days are March 25th and 26th. Don't worry, North Carolina hunters, we have the information on that as well. There is a youth week taking place in North Carolina. It is April 1st through the 7th.
And that's no April Fool's joke.
Not at all. And the rest of the state's opening up for us old people April 8th through May 6th. Of course, there's a limit to two turkeys for the season. And Sunday hunting is prohibited, at least on public land, since 1868 in North Carolina. So there you go. Now you know. Now, there's some things that you need to do to prepare, and if you're in North Carolina, you have a little bit longer, and in South Carolina, if you're in the Charlotte metro region, you have till April 1st to prepare by patterning your shotgun so that you know where those pellets are going to go as you are out there. And Jay Scott had some tips on the QI website that we're going to read up a little bit on. As he writes, springtime turkey hunting, always a pleasure being outdoors. Better to be early than late, he writes, setting his alarm 30 minutes earlier than the usual time so that he can get an early start. Take a few more calls than you may need. Now, we're going to come back to that because overcalling is a frequently occurring thing. So take more than you need, but then be prepared not to use them. Locator calls don't have to be perfect. So if you're using a coyote howler, an owl hooter, or a peacock, you don't have to sound exactly like the natural thing to be effective in getting the birds to gobble in the roost. Number four, don't blow a coyote howler at roosted birds. Why is that? In the morning when you're too close, the roosted male turkey might answer, but they will be very leery to come into your space because thinking that they are prey to the predator of the coyote. An owl hooter is a much better choice, Scott writes. Pinpoint, and this is a preseason scouting mission, Christopher Lawin, pinpoint where the birds are roosting. Secondly, beyond that, tactics, once they're on the ground, use the pathways, the ridgeways, the roadways, so that you're prepared to move if you need to jump in the traffic of the turkey as they're traveling. Play hard to get. That goes to not making too many calls. And, Christopher, you know what playing hard to get means.
Well, Bill, I've heard that you're pretty good on making some of those calls without the actual callers.
Oh, yeah, I've been working
on
that.
So you can, yeah.
Be patient is another one. Again, going not to using two more calls. Scott writes, use the roads to your advantage. We just talked a little bit about that. If you're on foot, you can use them, but also you can wake up early and drive to an area that you have seen or heard turkeys. And again, if you're just joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors, we're preparing for the Carolina Outdoors wild turkey seasons in both North and South Carolina. And we mentioned that South Carolina opens up a little bit earlier, especially in zones 3 and 4. That's the low country. And then South Carolina 1 and 2 opens April 1st, and North Carolina proper opens April the 8th. Calling cadence outweighs tone and sound if you're out there preparing for that turkey to approach. This I found very interesting. Decoy positioning. Position your turkey decoys at a 45-degree angle from the hunter on the opposite side of where you think the gobbler is going to come in from. And I think that guy has all of the advice from Jay Scott on the QI website.
It's kind of like a science. I mean, it really is, and I'm sure the more you do it, the more adept and polished you become, but you're still working with nature.
As is anything. Hey, and usually we stick to the wildlife, the outdoor activities, the hiking, the fishing, the hunting, those sorts of things. But we don't get into the political arena here on the Carolina Outdoors, and we know that you, the listeners, appreciate that, we hope. However, in the news on WBT through the week, as we blast up and down the Eastern Seaboard early on a Saturday morning, presidential indictments and arrests have been in the news. Christopher, when we come back, we're going to talk about no president has ever been indicted, but one has been arrested.
Oh,
stay tuned to the Carolina Outdoors to learn more. Christopher Lawin, I'm Bill Barty. We'll be right back. Hey, Monday through Friday here on WBT, and if you're listening to the podcast, this is a terrestrial radio show that is a podcast as well. But News Talk is the radio station, and oftentimes you hear about politics. And in politics, President Donald Trump claimed that he was going to be arrested upcoming because of an investigation that was going on. And we looked it up, and then Mike Rosenwald with the Washington Post helped us out a little bit. A president has never been indicted, but one was arrested. Welcome, everyone, to the Carolina Outdoors. Bill Barty on this side, Christopher Lawing on that side. Christopher, your job is to say, what president?
Who was the president, Bill?
Well, let me tell you what. This happened in 1872, and you can look that up on Google, who the president was. But we had a president that liked fast horses. And, in fact, in his horse-drawn carriage, he liked to get going fast. So in 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant was arrested at the corner of 13th and M Streets, northwest in Washington, D.C. So it wasn't a high crime. It was just a misdemeanor. But let me tell you how this went down. And this was confirmed in 2012 by Kathy Lanier, who is D.C.'s police chief, was told way back in the turn of the century about this. Grant's love of fast horses. He was an ardent admirer of a good horse and loved nothing better than sit behind a pair of spirited animals. This was in the Washington Star reported. He was a good driver and sometimes let them out to try their mettle. And that's where he got in trouble.
So he had a need for speed, in other words.
Yes, he did. Go a little Top Gun right there. The police had been receiving complaints of speeding carriages, and a mother and child in Washington, D.C. were run over and badly injured.
By others, not by Grant.
Yes. Police officer there, Officer West, was dispatched to investigate, and as he spoke to witnesses, another group of speeding carriages headed toward him, including one driven by the President of the United States. West held up his hand for them to stop. Grant was driving a pair of fast steppers, and he had some difficulty in halting them, but he managed to do it. The President, President Grant, was a bit testy. "Well, officer," he said, and these are in quotes, "what do you want to do with me?" West replied, "I want to inform you, Mr. President, that you are violating the law of speeding along this street. Your fast driving, sir, has set the example for a lot of other gentlemen," unquote. The president apologized, promised it wouldn't happen again, and galloped away. But Grant could not curb, in your words, his need for speed. So the next evening, West was patrolling again at the corner of 13th and M Streets when the president came barreling through again, this time speeding so fast that it took him an entire block of Washington, D.C. to stop. Now, Grant was cocky, and he had a smile on his face. The Star reported back in 1908 or whenever it was. He looked like a schoolboy who had been caught in a guilty act by a teacher. Grant said, "Do you think, officer, that I was violating the speed laws?" "I do, Mr. President," West said. Grant had an excuse for his speeding. He had no idea he had been going that fast. That sounds like a familiar excuse for me and the South Carolina Highway Patrol. West was sympathetic but firm. He said, "I am very sorry, Mr. President, to have to do it, but you are the chief of the nation, and I am nothing but a policeman. But duty is duty, sir, and I will have to place you under arrest." Lanier, the historian, confirmed the arrest, and there are other historical references to it. Grant and several of his speeding buddies, who were also arrested, went with West to the police station. The president was ordered to put up $20 as collateral. A trial was held the next day. 32 ladies of the most refined character and surroundings voluntarily came into the court and testified against the drivers, the Star story said. The cases were contested bitterly. The judge imposed heavy fines and a scathing rebuke to the speeding drivers, who did not include the president. He didn't show up for court.
And we don't know those circumstances. Maybe somebody had been paid off, or maybe they said, "Mr. President, we'll let this slide," but we don't know those circumstances.
What a story there on the Carolina Outdoors.
But, Bill, let's take a step back. Let's think about this. So let's get some context here. Okay, Grant, a sitting president, just pieced the nation back together. Head of, you know, the Northern Army's presidential representation, countries getting back together. And we have an officer who, in his words, said, "I am nothing but an officer, and you are the chief of our nation." That's impressive. He was doing his duty, and truly was, and no individual of fame or riches or whatever would prevent him from doing that. That must have taken some guts to call him on that.
Yeah, well, that's true. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about a president that was arrested, Ulysses S. Grant, way back in 1872, I think was the year, with Christopher Lawing and Bill Bartee from Jesse Brown's Outdoors, jessebrowns.com. And that reminds me, of course, we talk a lot about fishing. And in the upcoming segment, we're going to have Jake Rash from the North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission join us to talk a little bit more about fish. But this also popped up, and Ben Brash wrote about it in the Washington Post. It's about a whale that sank a boat. Now, this just happened, one in March 13th. A boat sank. Of course, they had technology. They had locating devices, GPSs, communication. But it made a reminder to Brash that a whale sank about 200 years ago as well. And what followed included one of America's greatest pieces of literature, Moby Dick. And that was when an enraged whale had wrecked their ship, setting the crew adrift in the Pacific Ocean. 2 torturous months at sea later, the sailors who had to go to cannibalism to survive, Christopher, came about the book Moby Dick. Now, you have insight into this book and the historical record of these whale hunters and the need for, I guess they were after the oils that were in the whales, and it was for street lamps. It was for your lamps at home back in the 1820s.
Now, I wasn't there, Bill.
You told me you were.
I wasn't there. But there's a book that we can read that'll tell us about it.
And that's what it is.
And that book is a beautiful read. It's by Nathaniel Philbrick, titled In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. And this is a story that probably, as we think and previous generations have thought about the severity of the tragedy of the Titanic, this was their Titanic before the Titanic. This was a tragedy of a great whaling ship out of Nantucket, Massachusetts.
The Essex.
Yeah, that was what it was called. And it was based out of Nantucket. That was a huge whaling center. A whale did a number on that boat, and it sank. And, you know, these guys were sailors and shipmen who were out there to harvest the oil from these whales, as Bill, you mentioned, were to power the streetlights and lamps. And quite a tragedy.
Well, the way the Essex ended up, the final crew consisted of 20 sailors. It included the captain's first cousin, Owen Coffin. The captain had promised the teen's mother he'd take care of her boy. Their mission was to fill the ship with whale blubber, an essential resource in the era of oil lamps. But this enraged whale struck the vessel. This is November of 1820. They were 1,300 miles from land. All 20 survived, but they were left listless, and 3 jury-rigged boats was written in the Pacific. The mistake they made was they didn't sail downwind to the closest island. That would have taken them 20 to 30 days to reach. They continued kind of maintaining their food as long as they could on these makeshift boats. They put sails up, but that just made it harder in many circumstances. When the food went out, they became weak, and as sailors died, I know this is unpleasant, they began cannibalism. And then after that, they began drawing straws. So in February of 1820, after 89 days at sea, the three remaining sailors went to an island, essentially. And it was a saga. And from this true story saga came Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
It made ripples in the news of that era. That was quite a time.
Well, and I must say, when Moby the Dick, I found this out just researching about the wreck of the Essex. This saga went on until 1823, while in the remote northwestern Hawaiian Islands, a storm struck and sank the two brothers, which Captain Pollard was the captain of. He survived that one as well, returned to Nantucket, and became the town's night watchman. And then he began sharing the story of the Essex while he was a night watchman. Melville, a 21-year-old Melville, started his whaling career that included a brief stint deserted on a Pacific island, and then his literary hit, formerly titled Moby Dick, or also known as The Whale, it flopped when it was published in 1851. It sold 2,915 copies at about $1.50 a piece, netting about $500 for Melville.
I guess after his royalties and fees were taken out and everything.
Well, when he died in 1891, according to the museum, it wasn't about four decades later when Random House's 1930 printing developed it into a seminal piece of American literature that it remains nearly a century later. This is all in the Washington Post. Christopher, we parked this thing up because it's leading into another fish story, opening day of trout season in North Carolina, that we're going to talk about in the next segment.
Much smaller fish, but still a whale of a good time.
And a whale of a story. And speaking of story, we have it on the docket for April 27th. We know it's a ways out there, but please save the date. It's a Thursday night. Come Hear Your Neighbor's Adventure. We have three new stories to go up onto the storyteller stage at Jesse Brown's, starting us off Roman Phillips' Beyond Eagle, followed by Helen Hosley's Wearing the Neat Hat, and finally Russ Van Buren's going to tell the story Rise from Collapse, all at Jesse Brown's, start time 6 o'clock. We'll be out of there by 8 p.m. You are all invited. He's Christopher Lawing. I'm Bill Barty. You're listening to the Carolina Outdoors. Hey, what's April 1 mean to so many people?
I can think of a couple things, Bill.
We'll get into the details, but
yeah.
I know what it means for so many. Christopher Lawing right there, Bill Barty right here. The Carolina Outdoors is now in session. And April 1st means April Fool's Day and all of that. And we're going to talk about wild turkey. Turkey season's coming into play, or is in play, depending on what side of the border that you're on, as far as South Carolina to North Carolina. South Carolina with the many different game zones. We'll talk about that. And, of course, North Carolina with the youth extended youth season for turkey. But we're going to talk about April 1 because it is opening day of trout season. And for so many different anglers, not only North Carolina residents, but people that are coming in from other states to use and utilize our fisheries and our waters, we're going to learn a little bit about what these designations mean and what opening day means to those anglers. And with that, we're going to bring on our friend Jake Rash. He's the Cold Water Research Coordinator for the Inland Fisheries Division. We're talking NC Wildlife Resource Commission on the Carolina Outdoors. Jake, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to chatting.
Well, Jake, you do so much of your work outside of the season throughout the year preparing for this. But for us recreational anglers, it means a whole lot. In fact, the 7 a.m. April 1 opening time, if you go to a place like Linville or go to a place like Wilson Gorge, that Brown Mountain Beach Road would be like Disney World. Jake, will you talk to us about opening day and that segmentation of hatchery-supported waters compared to the other waters that we have in western North Carolina to fish?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit it spot on there about how much those waters mean to so many people. You know, that opening day weekend is something that a lot of families have done together for generations, and folks that are maybe newer to North Carolina are finding out about and enjoying as well. And what that really entails is that first Saturday in April, and this year that's going to be on April 1st, as you noted. At 7 a.m., those waters that we stock pretty intensively in our hatchery-supported trout waters program, they actually open up. So as the name implies, it's opening day, and that season begins on those waters for folks to be able to catch and harvest fish in those selected waters. And I think, you know, as we're talking about and we've talked about before, those are a really big and important part of our program, but there are so many other waters in North Carolina that we work to manage the trout resources in, and we do that through a bunch of different regulations and opportunities that come with those. And I'd definitely be glad to talk about those as well.
Well, talk to us a little bit. You mentioned the tradition. It is a big tradition, but that date stays pretty darn true. Those waters close at the end of February. No fishing allowed on the hatchery-supported waters. And then it opens on that April 1st day. There's other regulations in the Wildlife Resource Commission. We won't make you speak to that, but sometimes there's a sliding scale of those dates may move. But the migratory hunts, like a Labor Day for dove season, that's a pretty true set traditional date that's set. But also this April 1st date is a pretty hard date. Is there ever any pressure to extend the season or shorten the season? And after you answer that, we're going to ask you about those hatcheries. I think you used three or four different ones. But talk to us about the hard April 1st date. Is there ever pressure to move that?
Well, you're right. It's set. It's that first Saturday in April. So whenever that falls, and this year it just happens to be April 1st, but that's what folks know. You know, in a general sense, the waters, you know, close in March, but sometimes, you know, that may stretch a little longer depending on that first weekend in April when that Saturday falls. But folks know that they can look towards that weekend, look towards that Saturday, and that's been around for a while. The season changed back in the 70s to basically what we know today. So that opening day as we know it has been around for a good while now, and on those hatchery supported waters, it's definitely one of the busier times for them, just with folks got that date circled and trips planned and looking to get out, you know, kind of as I noted earlier on, which is something that most likely they've done for a while. And if they haven't and are learning about it, it's a good opportunity to get out and go fishing.
Hey, Jake, talk to us a little bit about the program. You mentioned it, and this is intentional the way this works. And, of course, you as a cold water research coordinator play a huge part in the planning of the programs. First off, will you talk about the hatcheries that the state utilizes and the fish that they raise for these stockings?
Yeah, we're really fortunate to have just absolutely talented and devoted folks that are working in our facilities. And our primary production facilities for trout are at the Bobby and Setzer State Fish Hatchery, which is near Brevard, and then the Armstrong State Fish Hatchery just north of Marion. And we also keep trout seasonally over at Table Rock near Morganton, and and do some work out of the Marion facility as well. So it's really a team effort of folks working together, looking to grow a fish and have them stocked in places that folks really want to get out to sea, to get out to catch, and they really do a amazing job at doing that. On average, the fish that we're stocking are just about 10.5 inches. 4% of the fish we stock are over 14 inches. So those are really nice fish, and making sure that the waters are getting those. And in essence, we're stocking about 1 million fish and close to about 1,000 miles of water each year. And it's a year-round process, like you mentioned, from the work to figuring out where they go to the work to growing those fish and getting them in the water. And it's something that we're definitely proud of, and we hope folks are out there enjoying it.
We've got Jake Rash on. He's Coldwater Research Coordinator for the Inland Fisheries Division. For those of you just joining us, it's opening day of trout season on April 1st, and it's something to talk about. It is a tradition like no other, CBS would say about the Masters, and that's what we say about North Carolina trout season. But that's the hatchery-supported water. Jake, will you here on the Carolina Outdoors, we end up oftentimes talking about delayed harvest water, and that's a program that came on in the early 1990s. That water never did close during the month of March. It's been wide open, and the one difference between April 1st on the delayed harvest waters and the hatchery supported waters, will you tell us?
Yeah, the biggest difference is on those delayed harvest waters, they're catch and release half of the year. So
can't keep them.
So you gotta wait until June until you can harvest out of take fish out of a delayed harvest stream, and that's something that sometimes anglers can be confused about, those different regulations and what you can do where and what what this sign may mean and that sort of thing. So definitely two different programs, and really urge folks to take a look at ncwildlife.org/trout to dive in deeper to the regulations. And we even have interactive maps where they can look and find either, delayed harvest waters where, again, it's catch and release one part of the year and then you're able to harvest the other, or those hatchery supported waters that we were talking about earlier that open up here in that first Saturday in April.
Well, Jake, you're up there in the mountains too, so you got plenty of trout streams. But for us down here in Charlotte, as the Carolina Outdoors broadcast, those delayed harvest streams provide close trout streams, stock close trout streams that we can do easy in a day, an hour and a half or less for many of us in the Charlotte area anyway. We can access those trout streams. We just can't keep the fish.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. You can get to those delayed harvest streams, and you can't keep them until it's half the year. And so starting in October all the way through June, so this time of year it's catch and release. And then once we get into June, as those waters start to warm up, you are able to harvest. But you're exactly right. This time of year, if you hit a delayed harvest water, it's catch and release.
Now, Jake, I'm going to jump in and I'm going to change gears just a little bit. I want to hear, and I think some of our audience probably will too, what is your fishing story? What was your inspiration? Mm. How did you get involved on up through degrees in college and career placement and everything?
He went to NC State. That's what he's fishing for.
That's what I'm fishing for.
Lines of Stater over here.
Go Pack.
That's right. Go Pack.
Woo!
Yeah. It started with, similar to my, opening comments about generational elements to this. And it's kind of a common story when you talk to folks, usually there's somebody took them, took them fishing, and that was me. I grew up fishing with my dad, and and great grandparents even. I even had a great aunt that lived across the street, and we would go fish for chubs with cane poles and in creeks and around the Piedmont in North Carolina. So I was just obsessed with fish, and then I was fortunate enough to head to NC State and then on up to Virginia Tech for some additional school focused on fisheries and wildlife, and it's just a passion with the animals, and a passion, you know, for the people that enjoy them and the places that they live, and that kind of passion that I have is, that's not an uncommon story. Chances are, any fish biologist you talk to, they probably got into this by being way into fishing and then just being fortunate enough to take it on. So, you know, I always tell people, you know, I may not be out, you know, hook and line, but I'm at least, you know, able to be thinking about fish most days, which is, you know, which is still, I think, for my wife, kind of weird to process that I'm into fish that much. But when I get around other fish folks like y'all and being able to talk fishing, it makes sense. So I'm definitely still into it and feel pretty lucky to be doing what I'm doing.
And you get paid to do it too. That's the thing. It's a dream come true and a passion from life, but you get paid for it.
Yeah, we are lucky enough to be able to have careers, and I think, you know, that's a part of it. But in this line of work, you're working with the fish and the people and their habitats, and so you know, you're able to work on and think about things that hopefully have a longer legacy impact. We're trying to work and make fishing better for today, and trying to help do things like save native brook trout and conserve them where we can. That's awesome for us today, but you know, really, we're always thinking about, you know, that next generation and who's going to have the next story to tell about these amazing fish and these amazing places in North Carolina. So that's really cool stuff, and that helps me get out of bed every morning and get back after.
Oh, yeah, y'all are caretakers and thinking ahead on that, so that's pretty cool.
Well, you're also an educator, and we're glad you're on here educating us and educating our listeners. Will you talk to us a little bit about what it takes for us, the sportsmen, the sports people, to be better anglers and better, I guess, citizens of the environment in understanding what's going on with the trout? Because I theorize that the more knowledge that we have, the better anglers that we can be. What are you finding out there as you're working with the fish and the fish are ending up working with the anglers? Are anglers becoming more and more knowledgeable, or how are we as sporting people outdoors with these fish?
Yeah, that's an awesome question, and I think you're exactly right. I think everybody's becoming more aware and more knowledgeable. Technology's definitely helped a lot.
Yes.
You know, great things like, you know, podcasts that are sharing really good information, and websites are out there, and information exchange. But just that awareness, you know, for instance, we shared a press release that spoke to trout anglers about reporting hellbender sightings. If you're out trout fishing, letting the agency know. And we recently had an article on our Wildlife in North Carolina magazine that talks about some of the other, you know, really neat fish that you might catch while you're trout fishing. And both of those topics speak to this bigger concept of aquatic conservation. We may go out there thinking about trout, but, you know, it turns out that if we've got good habitat for the trout to live, well, that's helping maybe that's helping hellbenders. That's helping these other fish that live there. And so if we're able to do these efforts to really help, you know, take care of the waters of our favorite places or our favorite fish, you know, like if it's trout, well, that's kind of rolling downstream. It's sort of a conservation multiplier where we're doing good work up on the top of the watersheds where the water starts flowing, and that better water is moving downstream to other animals that depend on it and other people that may depend on it or enjoy it too. So it's kind of this concept of things in nature being connected and us just working together, working with each other and working with the habitats where all these things live in the water to help them be as the best they can be, and knowing that what we can do can have a big impact beyond maybe what we showed up to fish for that day.
Well said. That is as well said as it can be, because it's not mutually exclusive. It's all hooked together, and as goes the trout, so goes many other wildlife and everything that's hooked to it. Jake Rash, we appreciate you jumping on the Carolina Outdoors. We love getting you on. We love celebrating opening day of trout season in North Carolina with you. Thank you for jumping on with the Outdoor Guys from Jesse Brown's.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. I really appreciate y'all having me.
And there he goes. That's Jake Rash. And there he goes. Christopher Lawing, I'm Bill Barty. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and wrap up the rest of the Carolina Outdoors. We got to wrap this thing up called the Carolina Outdoors. Bill Barty on this side, Christopher Lawing on that side. Christopher, what did we learn on the program today?
Oh, goodness. We covered everything and learned everything from turkeys to fish to whales to historical, context stories and fun stuff. So you're going to have a blast.
Taking it all in. Of course, we're preparing for the opening day of turkey season because it's coming on strong, essentially April 1st in South Carolina and April 8th in North Carolina. And those seasons will go on for a month or so. You taught me a lot about harvesting whale blubber for the oil lamps that I do not have. But also the birthplace of the book Moby Dick.
Green energy, Bill. Green energy.
That is the origination of it. Also, Jake Rash jumped on here to break down opening day of trout season as well. In North Carolina, of course, this trout need that cold water, and he is a cold water research coordinator for the NC Wildlife Resource Commission, and he gave us the breakdown of the hatchery-supported streams that are opening up. You can keep 7 fish. Again, he also explained delayed harvest, where we still can't keep any fish until the first Saturday in June. So we learned a whole bunch about that. I don't think he told us where they stock the big ones, though.
I don't know. No, but he did tell us he went to NC State, so we know he's a good guy because of that.
He's a good friend of yours just because of that.
Yeah.
Something else, we like to put this out there. We spoke about it a little bit. Of course, Christopher and I hang our hat at Jesse Brown's Outdoors, the local Charlotte outfitter, the outfitter near you, purveying fine brands like Sims, Patagonia, Sage Fly Rods, and a lot others. We just added a new arrow to the quiver with the addition of Free Fly. It's a Carolina outdoor clothing company with sun protection and fly fishing DNA based in it. Stop by Jesse Brown's for your Free Fly. And if you need a pair of hiking boots or something along the way, of course, use Hike 25. It's a discount code at jessebrowns.com on any of your purchases of $100 or more. It'll save you 25, just like that.
Ding.
With that being said, we have some events that are taking place at Jesse Brown's. We want you to mark your calendar. We have the Urban Hike. It's a 7.7-mile hike with guides taking us along the way, the neighborhoods of Charlotte. 7.7 sounds like it's long, but over the course of 4 or so hours, you will learn about places you have driven by in Charlotte time after time. You'll have a whole new perspective. Your summit, your reward, your view for finishing is Legion Brewing there in the South Park area. Everyone is invited. It is April 23rd. And then April 27th at Jesse Brown's Storytellers Night is taking place. All are welcome. 6 p.m. 3 brand new stories on the stage. Come hear a neighbor's adventure. Special thanks to Jake Rash for joining us here on the Carolina Outdoors. For Christopher Lyon and TJ the DJ Boggs, this is Bill Barty saying, make the Carolina Outdoors look a little bit better than you found it. And pick up your trash. Trash.